the big red flag, which is a huge red flag, really, when we think about it, is that the original manuscript, if it ever was a Dun Huang manuscript, was destroyed according to nothing but the word of mouth of this guy. It was destroyed in the Cultural Revolution. And all we have is several copies that were recollections written down from the memory of the guy who inherited the text from his grandfather.
I'm Michael Max, and this is Geological. Different languages parse reality in different ways, like a diamond cutter slices facets to bring out something unique in a stone. One language can reveal what another language might hide. One of the benefits of learning a second language as an adult is that in the process of renaming the world with new sounds, you get a deeper glimpse into your mother tongue. Partly, this is due to learning words with the nervous system of a matured adult. And so the emotional content that rides along with the words we learned as children, it's not there. And so it might be easier to say, I can't stand that in your foreign tongue, but there's entirely too much emotional baggage riding on that phrase in your mother tongue. You might find that you're braver in your second language because you don't worry about sounding like an idiot. It's a foregone conclusion that you're going to twist up the grammar and not quite be able to wrap your tongue around the standard pronunciation. There's kind of a liberation in that. And sometimes, due to the habits of culture and the way that grammar parses how you think, it can be helpful to chew on a problem in your second language because it actually does see the world differently. And there are solutions to problems that can arise that will not be available to you in your native language. One of my favorite things about Chinese is that it's slippery and connective. It tends to leave things open instead of nailing them down. It's a language that relies on context. You can see how the medicine gets its nuance as it's less about nailing things down and more about opening up to the permutations of what something is within the fluid frame of unceasing change. The other thing about the Chinese language, especially the traditionally written form, is that the characters will often tell you a story that, in turn, allows you to unfold your experience with a multivalent attention. For example, the word ting, which means listen, it's made up of the characters ear, eyes, heart, and mind. Another character that I think about a lot is the character li, which is generally translated as pattern, connection, logic, order, reason, or sequence. The image associated with this character is the pattern of color that runs through a piece of jade. It's a moment frozen in time that reveals the pattern process of something, just as the grain of wood in your furniture bespeaks the unfolding of a tree through the seasons and cycles of its growth. Another way to think of Li is that it's coherence. And I think of it this way often in clinic, that the work we do is to connect with a patient's Li, their pattern of emergence in this world, and lean on that to help them with what life is asking of them in this moment. We have a phrase in English, against the grain. It usually means that you're working counter to the flow of what's going on. Often, patients come to us because they're not living in alignment with their most core aspects. When we deviate from the patterning of who we truly are, trouble is bound to arise. Patients ask me about how acupuncture works, and 20 plus years into the practice, that question is as much of a challenge to me as it ever was. In the past, I'd talk about channel flows or the role of nerves and endocrinological function. People like it when they feel like their minds can grasp something. But lately, I've taken to telling my patients that there is something in them that has a kind of intelligence that allowed two cells to come together and create one, and from there, grow into what became a baby, and that then allowed them to grow into the person they are today. That which makes us also heals us. We are ever in a state of arising, decay, unfolding, and being. Call it the spiral unfolding of DNA through the cycle of life, with a patterning of Li. In the same way jade has its striations, Flowers bloom in their perfect circumstances. Leaves turn yellow and fall in symphonic resonance with the waning light. We humans, too, have a patterning that resonates with the world around us. Li is not something that's easily nailed down. It's more like being invited into a conversation that matters. The kind of conversation that you don't know the outcome of. While Li can mean manage or control, it's not the kind of control that comes from a self-involved force of will, but more the control spoken of in the Tao Te Ching, whereby understanding the way things work, you can position yourself in an advantageous way. When you understand how things flow, when you live in accord with the tides and the flows, you're less likely to work against nature and less inclined to go against the grain. We often talk about fighting disease, but can you keep your eye on what's going right and use that to intervene with what's going wrong? Can you work with your patients as they are, or are you asking them to be different from who they actually are? As practitioners, we like to see our patients get better, and we like to feel like we're competent and helpful. I suspect the superior doctor takes his or her work seriously, and at the same time, leaves room for a patient to respond and be who they are. And when I say who they are, I mean they respect the Li of a patient, understand that people have their own resources and ways of navigating life. Is it our job to make patients different or to help them connect more fully with their own Li in a way that brings a greater coherence to their lives and allow that coherence to do the work of healing in whatever way is right for that person? The thing I appreciate about considering Li is that it's an invitation to step back, appreciate a wider view, and recognize that the resources for healing are within our patients. And attending to the aspect of coherence in your patients' lives allows their innate patterning to emerge more fully. I think it's trustworthy. In a moment, we're going to get into this conversation on the mythic roots of the Tang Ye Jing and the curious story of the Fuxing Zhe. This will be like two detective stories that have been woven together and invites us into considering what we know, the sources we hold close as reliable, and regardless of source, do the methods discussed help us in our clinical work? Our medicine has come down to us through centuries of other doctors' experience. Our job is to explore how it unfolds in our particular time and circumstance. I love this conversation with Sabine Wilms, and I hope that you're going to enjoy it as well. But first, a couple things you should know about. As always, I'm appreciative of you Chiologicians who support Chiological with a yearly or monthly membership. Your contribution to this effort is an essential component in making it possible to bring you these conversations every week. As a thank you, Chiologicians receive some extra perks with their membership. To help support the podcast and take advantage of these extras, visit the website and look under the Chiologicians menu. I have a quick word here about the Shennong Society. You herbalists in the know look forward to the springtime because that is when the Shennong Society holds their conference. This year's one-day event has a focus on the lower jowl, and it will be live-streamed on April the 17th. Dr. Yuning Wu will be presenting on endometriosis, Lorraine Wilcox is cooking up something special with herbs, and Mazen Al-Kafaji will share his perspective on IBS. Visit shennongsociety.org for the details and to register for this day of learning with these world-class practitioners. Lhasa is the sponsor of today's conversation. Lhasa OMS supports your practice with your favorite needles, wide selection of herbs, clinic supplies, along with webinars, informational blog posts, and learning resources that serve and connect our community of practitioners. In addition to all the supplies you'd expect, Lhasa also has all the safety and sanitizing supplies you require as we continue the challenge of caring for our patients in the midst of the COVID pandemic. Lhasa also carries a wide variety of CBD products in all its forms, from lotions to patches to tablets to oils. Sign up on their website for notices on flash sales and to be informed on their webinar series. Lhasa OMS, supporting your practice and our community with clinical resources and education. Alrighty, friends, here we go. Tanya Jing by way of the Fuxing Zhe. Buckle up. Sabina Vilms, welcome to Geological.
Oh, thank you for having me again, Michael. It's always a pleasure and a total honor.
It's always a blast talking to you. You're always doing something new and interesting. It's like you do a book and then you like take two or three breaths and then you're like into another book or a series of books or this or that. You're like one of the most productive people I know when it comes to translation work. And it's always such a delight to read what you do because it comes so from the heart. You have, in my view, such a keen sense of wanting to take these ancient words and make them alive in our current context. And your books just read like poetry so often because, you know, you bring in some Zhuangzi and you bring in some Laozi.
You can't help it.
Right. You can't help it. So it's really lovely. I'm always delighted to talk with you today. I've been looking forward to this for a couple of weeks now because while it's probably going to be available by the time this podcast comes out, there's a new book you've got on a thing that most people have not heard about called the Fuxing Zhe. They probably heard about the Tanya Jing, but we're gonna get into all that here in just a second. And this is such an interesting topic for me because I first heard about the Tanya Jing, I don't know, a while back, right? I'm an herbalist. And yeah. So this Tanya Jing thing, it's like a mythic creature, right? It's like a unicorn. It's like some kind of mythical beast.
It's a Loch Ness monster that shows up.
The Loch Ness monster, Chinese medicine. It's like, look, there it is. No, it's not. Wait a minute. No, that's an old tire. What the hell is that thing? And so, you know, we've had some conversations over this time. And the Tanya Jing is something that's gaining a lot of attention. But what's curious about it, it's one of these, I'm using air quotes here, it's a lost text. And I've always wondered since I started studying Chinese medicine about these like lost texts, right? Like, how do we know about it if it's lost?
That is a great question.
And like, how do we know what to trust with it? And it's like, is it even real? Or is it a flight of fantasy? And so I've had a chance to pre-read some of your book. Thank you very much. It's been a delight. And one of the fascinating things about it is there's this, I mean, we go on a little history trip. So before we get into all that, what I want to know is what got you interested in taking this on? And then we're going to get on the train, Chinese medicine history train, and take a look. But what got you started on doing this?
Well, I think it's kind of like what you said, that I was talking to my clinical colleagues, and I would be teaching with various people who I respect greatly, and they would bring up the Tanya Jing as this classic of decoctions. And I'm like, what is this text? What are you talking about? And they're like, oh, it's this ancient classic that was lost and rediscovered. I'm like, well, this is just weird. How come I've never heard of this?
How did Sabina Vilms not hear of the Tanya?
There's only so many Han Dynasty texts or even Tang Dynasty texts. And as a medical historian specializing in that early period, I know them all. I mean, I haven't read them all cover to cover. But what is this decoction classic? What is this Tanya Jing? And that just kind of, you know, we'd be in the middle of a conversation or a seminar teaching or something. So we just move on to something else. And I just pushed it aside. And that went on for a few years. And then finally it just got to the point where it's like, no, people just keep bringing this up. And I got to just dig a little deeper and figure out what it is. And then I somehow, I don't know, I think it was this spring. I mean, yeah, you're right. I jumped from one projecting to the next. I finished the Channeling the Moon part two, and I got kind of, I mean, I love gynecology, but But the channeling the moon parts one and two, especially the part two was really hard work. It was like a 500-page book, and a lot of it, it was not that much fun. The translation was a really small part of it, and a lot of it was tracking down each formula and each quotation and just doing a lot of textual research. So I got a little, I was like, okay, I'm going to take a break and do something else.
So you thought you'd do the Tanya Jing as a way of like relaxing and unwinding.
Well, actually, no, the pandemic hit. So, you know, I was like, okay, what, like, I think we all sat and went quiet and, you know, what, like, I feel this huge urgency to produce work that is meaningful. And I have a giant, giant pile of projects that I want to do that I feel can help practitioners. Mm-hmm. Like, I would love to just read Laozi and Zhuangzi, but there are so many great translations of Laozi and Zhuangzi out there that you guys don't need another Laozi. I need to translate Laozi for myself.
But how can you be productive and helpful in a way where it's needed?
Yeah. So I sat down and started Sun Cimiao's volume on Yangxing, on nurturing the inner nature, nurturing the heavenly nature, because it's all about self-care. Mm-hmm. It's about sleep hygiene, meditation, Qigong, living in harmony with nature, regulating your emotions. I mean, it's perfect for the pandemic. And I did that for a couple months. And then I honestly don't remember what happened. Somehow the Tanya Jing just like interfered with that lovely project, which now I can't wait to get back to Sun Cimiao, in all honesty. Somehow the Tanya Jing just like plopped in there, and it'd been on my, I think it'd been in the back of my mind for so long that it was just like, okay, here I am. And somehow I think I was looking through, I think Vivian Law's book on the Dunhuang medical manuscripts, and I came across Wang Shumin's article on that had Tanya Jing in the title. I think that's maybe where it all started. And I realized that what they're talking about, like nobody had made this clear to me, that it's really the Fuxing Jue that they're talking about. And the Fuxing Jue, so it's Fuxing Jue Zhang Fu Yong Yao Da Yao. It's a text that I actually had in my bookshelf in several editions, because it's a text that's included in some Dunhuang medical manuscripts. So Dunhuang is this oasis in the middle of the desert that was a very active Buddhist intercultural trading place on the Silk Road.
Out in the middle of nowhere.
In the desert. And it's this incredible, and I love the Tang Dynasty, because during the Tang Dynasty, you had, especially the first half of the Tang Dynasty, you have this influence of Central Asian and Indian culture. Really, Buddhism started coming into China in the late Han Dynasty. And I think Buddhism really changed Chinese culture deeply in a way that's hard for us to wrap our head around, because separating in Chinese philosophy, separating what is pre-Buddhism and what is past Buddhism, you have to have a certain kind of training in classical philosophy to kind of smell out, because we're Westerners and Buddhism came from Indo-European culture. So for us as Indo-European, as people from a Judeo-Christian, Indo-European background, we find something in Chinese culture that feels really familiar, like this idea of separation of mind and matter. Mm. The way Buddhism talks about the material realm as opposed to the immaterial realm.
Are you saying that the Buddhist influence in China helps to give us a handle on Chinese culture that we otherwise wouldn't have?
I think so.
That Chinese culture would be even harder to penetrate if it didn't have Buddhism, to our Western mind.
I think so. And I think, you know, and this is something that is really important for Chinese medicine people. I mean, as a historian, I am trained to think of, you know, Han Dynasty philosophy and Tang Dynasty philosophy or literature or culture or classical pre-Han, Han, Tang. There's a progression, whether you're talking about religion, culture, art, literature, medicine. And you can see the influence. And so I had my head in Sun Simya. Sun Simya was very much, he was early Tang Dynasty. He was very much influenced by Buddhism. So I think that's why I'm kind of visiting my books. And the Dunhuang, so Dunhuang was this outpost that was a very active Buddhist colony. And there were hundreds of caves. And in the early, and I'm so bad with dates. I should have made myself a little notepad with the important dates here. In the early 1900s, this monk who was kind of this Taoist monk who was this unofficial caretaker of the Dunhuang caves, and at the time, you know, early 1900s, there was like nothing going on in Dunhuang, and the Chinese Empire is kind of collapsing.
Oh, it's totally imploding.
It's total chaos, right?
Yeah.
So this is a total outpost. And this monk...
Total outpost in a dynasty that's falling apart.
Yes. Yes.
Say Changlanhuo.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? It's a mess. It's nothing but chaos.
Except they're in this desert outpost. So it's probably not as chaotic as it was in, you know, Shanghai or somewhere.
Okay.
So this monk smokes a cigarette. And he notices that the smoke of the cigarette.
The monk was smoking a cigarette.
Of course.
Only in China.
Or maybe a pipe. I don't know. Did they have cigarettes in the early? He was smoking. In the early 1900s. They didn't even have cigarettes then. Oh, see? I have to. This is like the perfect example where it's so easy for us to read things back. So, you know, into history when really the reality then was completely different. It's right. So easy to do. So there's smoke, and he discovers a crack in the wall, and he opens it up because the smoke does something weird. And he discovers this cave that was sealed in the early Song Dynasty, in the 10th Dynasty. And this cave is stuffed full, and it's been sealed for, what, 1,000 years or something? And this cave... This is the so-called library cave in Dunhuang, and it's now very famous. There's a whole field of studies. There's dozens of conferences that have happened and books published on all this material that came from this cave. Basically, it's like an archaeology. It's like Ma Wang Dui. It's like a tomb that was sealed at a certain time, and then we open it up 2,000 years later, and we're like,
"Ooh, treasure trove."
It's amazing. It's because it's not transmitted literature, but it's literature that was written and sealed. And the Dunhuang manuscripts, there's medical manuscripts, there's economic stuff, there's maps, there's astrology, there's a huge amount of material in Dunhuang. It's not just, I mean, it's revolutionized the field of Chinese history. The way we talk, everything we know about this border station, that what we know about military, what we know about the life of lower class people, it's this treasure trove of information. And I've worked with Dunhuang manuscripts before, trying to understand what Tang Dynasty or medieval, you know, medicine was like on the ground. Because all we have otherwise is these transmitted texts. And as you probably know, in the early Song Dynasty, all these texts were heavily edited and moved around and reorganized by the Song Dynasty, the emperor hired all these medical historians and editors to create standard editions, the standardization of medicine that happened in the Song Dynasty.
It's like the TCM of the Song Dynasty.
Yes, the official textbook versions, the official. This is the true version of the Yellow Emperor's classic.
So would you say it's like, would you say the early song was like the first standardization of the medicine?
Oh, dear. You're putting me on the record here.
Well, I don't mean to put you on the record. I don't know the history that well. I know the history like briefly. It's a long ass history. But I know that like one of the things about modern Chinese medicine, TCM, if you will, you know, was a kind of a standardization. And that's helpful in a certain way because it helps you to teach things quickly.
Yep.
But anytime you standardize something, you know, what do you do with what gets left out?
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, you don't even know it's been left out, right? It's just an empty space. And that's why it's helpful that there's, you know, all this other stuff.
And that's why, for example, like in the Humming with Elephants book.
My favorite.
I know you like it. Thank you very much. You know, all those discussions that I have where actually this commentator says it's a different character. So when you have these standard editions of the classics, you, in a way, you put the lid on all these discussions. You're just deciding this is the true version.
Capital T true. Okay, so we got the smoking monk finds this.
or maybe it was a campfire. Okay, so eliminate
this. No. I like, you know, I can see this monk. So my friend Toby Daly, who's been teaching me, learned it from this monk. And on occasion, the monk would be like hanging out in these parachute pants, smoking cigarettes, treating people, doing acupuncture. He's just like serious Buddhist monk smoking a cigarette.
Sure.
I love these kinds of things that in our Western mind, we go, that's such a contradiction. But, you know, the Eastern world is very different than us.
Yeah, I just don't know if they had cigarettes. Cigarettes weren't even invented in the early
1900s. Were smoking hand-rolled cigarettes. Anyway, whatever it was, doesn't matter. I like the image, so I'm keeping it, even though it may not be true. But they find this incredible treasure trove of material that changes how people think about the history.
I mean, it's basically this Taoist monk who has no training in philology. He's not a scholar. He's just this local guy who finds this cave that has been sealed for 1,000 years.
Okay.
And it's just stuffed full of scrolls, like just thousands of scrolls of ancient texts that were just stuffed into this space and sealed and hidden.
Can he even read this kind of stuff?
Well, that is a great question. He must have been literate because according to one story, he sold the Fuxingjue to the grandfather of the guy who submitted it to the Beijing Institute of Medical History, whatever. And the grandson told the story in the letter that he submitted that the monk told the guy that, oh, here's this text of medical, you know, this medical text. Here, give me some money and I'll sell it to you. So he must have been literate enough to know that this was a text
that it was about medicine,
medical information.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there are all these manuscripts. You get a British explorer carting off, selling. The Taoist monk sells a large percentage of these manuscripts to a British explorer who carts them off, and they're now in the British Museum in London. Then, slightly later, a French guy shows up, and he's actually a trained sinologist, and he buys most of what's left over, and he carts it off, and that is now all in Paris. And those two... And if you're into Dunhuang studies and you've got these books in your shelf, which any of you, all of you, of course have, right? Right? You have. Never mind, I'm a nerd. So if you're into Dunhuang studies, you know that that the texts are identified either with an S and a number or a P as a number, and the S stands for Oral Stein, which was the British explorer who classified, he listed all the manuscripts that he took to England. Mm-hmm. And then Pelliot was the French guy who took all the other ones to Paris. And these manuscripts are all preserved now, and they haven't gotten destroyed. And, you know, of course, this is colonial history. So basically, the Chinese got royally ripped off for like a pittance. And this takes us to the story of this text. So supposedly, this Taoist monk kept some manuscripts for himself. And this is where things get a little shady. This is the story. But, you know, I'm following Chinese archaeologists who I really respect, like Ma Jixing. I've got several books on the Dunhuang manuscripts, and this Fuxingjue text is included in these collections. So when I opened my book and I started looking, I have all these books on medical manuscripts from Dunhuang, and there's the text. It's right in there. I've got the Chinese in my, it's been sitting in my library for decades.
So you didn't have to go to London or Paris. It was in your library on Whidbey
Island. It was right there in several editions. I have like four different books. It's great. So I'm like, well, this is going to be a really easy project. I'm just going to crank this out. It's, you know, like everybody's talking about it. It's important that it's out there because people are like, well, what is this text? And what does it really say? And people who don't really know how to read classical Chinese are kind of quoting it and misquoting it. There's just all this, you know, and everybody talks about it, but nobody has really clear access to it. And here it is in my shelf. I'm like, okay, I'm just going to do a little detour and do this really quick.
A little detour.
Yeah. It was a little more than a little. It was a big detour. But you know, what else am I going to do in a pandemic? So basically, the story goes that the Taoist monk sold this manuscript to the grandfather of the guy who submitted it to the Beijing Institute of Medical History. And the guy did not submit the actual manuscript. The big problem, the big red flag, which is a huge red flag, really, when we think about it, is that the original manuscript, if it ever was a Dunhuang manuscript, the original manuscript was destroyed according to nothing but the word of mouth of this guy. It was destroyed in the Cultural Revolution. And all we have is several copies that were recollections written down from the memory of the guy who inherited the text from his grandfather and his students, disciples, whatever. So I have a book that has over 20 different versions of this text written. There's like three versions by this guy, and then all these disciples wrote their own versions, and so it gets way messier than I had anticipated.
So it gets weird quick. Let me make sure that I'm following this, okay? We got the Buddhist monk who's making a little bit of extra money by selling off these treasures at the end of a dynasty that's falling apart. You know, I mean, it's probably not a bad idea. Hey, this guy comes in. Hey, give me some money. Great, I get to eat and keep my Buddhist temple going and take these manuscripts.
Some go off to France,
some go off to England. One goes off to this guy's grandfather, but that one gets lost in the Cultural Revolution. So the grandson, let me make sure I got this, the grandson writes down from memory what he knew of those manuscripts.
Yes.
And sent it to Beijing.
You got it.
Someone could know.
It's a mess.
So that sounds a little fishy to me.
Yes, except that, I mean, I totally agree. And this may be because I'm a Western-trained medical historian. And I think as a historian from a Western background, we tend to be more critical and cynical than our Chinese colleagues.
Really? People making shit up in China and passing it off as authentic?
No. I'm talking about the medical historians. The guy who submitted it, whatever, you know, and he's published books about it. And I think he's kind of got his guru thing going, this group. And his students have published books, and they claim that it's the Tang Ye Jing. But
okay. So again, let me make sure that I got these timelines right.
Oh, yeah. It gets worse. We're not even halfway through the story. We're just beginning. But basically,
I get that, but I just want to make sure I understand this. So there's this lineage piece. It comes from the text in Beijing. It came from this guy who wrote it down himself. But the stuff that's on your bookshelf, is that from this cat?
Yes.
Or is that the stuff that's from this cat? What about the stuff that's in England or Paris?
Well, this is just one manuscript. And this manuscript, and this is the thing, the Fu Xingjue was never mentioned by any, it's never, this text has never been mentioned by anybody else. We have no, there is no record of the Fu Xingjue anywhere else. All we have is a guy who writes down, he jots down what he has memorized from a manuscript. And all we have is his word for it. And he submits it to this Beijing Institute. But here's the deal. And, you know, usually I would be like, oh, this sounds so flaky. But these medical historians who I really respect and who specialize in ancient medical literature, and they know all, they've got all these texts memorized. They have analyzed this material, that this handwritten manuscript that the guy sent off to the institute. They have analyzed this back and forth, and they have determined that this is, it's definitely not a Han Dynasty text. They have determined that it is quite likely that the guy's story is correct. And it is possible. So that it is a, and that means, so they have accepted that it is most likely a manuscript that came from among the Dunhuang manuscripts, which means it is roughly 6th through 10th century, which makes it a medieval text. They've analyzed the language, the content, the phrasing, the taboo characters. So the Fu Xingjue as a text, it's a really cool text that nobody knew about, that is found in this collection of medical manuscripts. And I've worked with other texts among the Dunhuang manuscripts. And I, you know, there's cool information in there because it's kind of like the medicine on the ground.
What do you mean by medicine on the ground?
Well, it's not what was cleaned up and standardized and processed and approved by the imperial Song government for general consumption and dissemination. Like when you look at, like when I did my dissertation research for Sun Simiao, or now when I'm working on Sun Simiao, I have several editions of Sun Simiao, and there are what we tend to work with. So we talk about the Neijing or the Shanghanlun or any of these texts, and we are like, it's a Han Dynasty text, right? The Shanghanlun. Well, not really. We don't have a copy from the Han Dynasty of the Shanghanlun. All we have is the transmitted texts from the Song Dynasty that were standardized in the Song Dynasty. So we really don't know what the Shanghanlun looked like in the Han Dynasty, I'm sorry to say.
Oh, wow.
I'm sorry.
Well,
I hate to burst that bubble.
I've heard this, that for like 400 years, the Shanghanlun was lost.
Yeah. And we don't have a Han Dynasty copy. I mean, I wish we did. And we have quotations in the Dunhuang manuscripts. And that's another reason. And like, I mean, there's no copy of Sun Simiao's work in the Dunhuang texts. But for Sun Simiao's writings, I went to a Japanese collection of medieval Chinese texts, because Japan is another place. These manuscripts were sold along with Buddhist texts. They were sold to Korea, and from Korea they made their way to Japan, either through Korea or directly. And in China, the Song Dynasty, this period of civil war between the Tang Dynasty, there were roughly 300 years between the Tang and the Song Dynasty, when you didn't have an empire, and there was warfare, libraries, there was a huge amount of book. I mean, books were written on, they were not printed yet, so they were very precious and very rare, and they were printed on silk or bamboo, and libraries went up in flames. So we have texts preserved in Japan, especially in this text called the Ishin Fang, Formulas from the Heart of Medicine, or Ishinpo, which is another text that I work with all the time. So when you talk about lost texts, the Ishinpo is full of quotations from lost texts. It's a gold mine. That's why I use the Ishinpo all the time.
So you really have to be kind of a historical detective to pull some of this stuff together. You have to really be able to span your awareness and understanding of how things are connected over hundreds and hundreds of years.
Yeah, it gets really complicated. But basically, the consensus in China is, and I'm going with that because I have a huge respect for the medical historians who've studied this these texts. They've compared the different manuscript versions. They interviewed the guy who memorized it. I mean, they've done the homework. And I'm sitting here on Whidbey Island, and I'm just going to take their word. I've decided if they include this text in all these collections, in the standard collections of Dunhuang medical manuscripts, I'm going to take their word for it.
Okay, so people that you trust who are well-schooled and top, you know, top-notch, have, because they've looked at how words are used and they look at how phrasing's used and ideas and all that, they go, well, he may have like written it down out of memory, but it's not out of character with these other things that we found in this time and place.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay. And it is so specific to the period that he couldn't have made it up, I think was probably their evaluation, that it just fits. And after studying this text and working with it really, really closely for a long time now, or not very long, but long enough, I agree with them that it really does fit the perfectly with the language around the environment of people like Sun Zimiao, Ge Hong, Tao Hongjing, this time period.
Okay. So we've got the Fuxing Zhe. How do you translate that into English?
I should have had my notepad. it's a really awkward text, and that's part of the problem. This text, okay, it's just a mouthful. Fuxing Zhe Zhang Fu Yong Yao Fa Yao. So
Fuxing Zhe is just like
Zhe is like helpful tricks or knacks.
Mm-hmm.
It can also have the connotation of a little secret, an esoteric, like a Taoist literature can be Zhe. These things that you can memorize, sometimes they're rhymed. And Fuxing as helpful for action.
Mm-hmm.
So secrets helpful for action. And then Zhangfu, the Zhangfu organs. Yong Yao, using medicinals. And Fa Yao as rules. Yao, like essentials, the crucial rules, the crux of using medicinals on the Zhangfu. And that's important. And all of this in helpful knacks or secret tricks or something like that.
Zhangfu tricks to keep up your sleeve.
Yeah, and we will put, I'm going to send you the title translation that I've settled on, and we can put it in the notes, okay?
Okay.
Because it literally, I mean, it cost me weeks and weeks of sleepless nights of it was the hardest thing to translate this darn title.
Help me understand here. Where's the Tang Ye Jing fit into all this?
This is where it gets messy and complicated, I think. So the Fuxing Zhe is a wonderful medieval text that is fascinating for me as a medical historian because it's in this time period between the classical age, the age when the classics were written, right? The Yellow Emperor's classic, the Shanghanlun, the Jingui. And then you have Sun Zimiao, and you have some Tang Dynasty text. And then from the Song Dynasty on, you have this explosion of medical literature because you have printing, you have a stable dynasty. I mean, starting with the Song Dynasty, we just have so many more texts that were preserved. You have the development of specializations like gynecology, pediatrics, you know, acupuncture, standardization of acupuncture locations, you know, the bronze figure, what we talked about, the standardization. So in the Song Dynasty, you have all this information. And for me, there's this gap. As a medical historian, there's a real gap between so-called classical or canonical or whatever you want to call it, Han Dynasty medicine, and then really the development of medicine as a professional practice that was sponsored by, that was supported by the government, where you had an imperial college of medicine and you had imperially appointed professors and you had a body of knowledge and you had giant imperially sponsored formula collections and you had a system of pharmacies by the empire that had standard patent medicines. So they were ready for epidemics in a way that you could never, there was nothing in Europe at this time period comparable to what the Chinese did. And then especially the Mongols. The Mongols were very practically oriented. So the Yuan Dynasty. But anyway, so that's much later. And in this period, and in the Han Dynasty, you have, you know, the Yellow Emperor's Classic, the Shang Hanlun, the Jingwei, the Meijing. And then you have this long gap. And now the Fuxing Zhuo falls right into that gap. And one of the things that happens is when you look at materia medica literature, the Shenong Benzhao Jing is not a very clinical, it's not a clinical text, right? The original version, the original version of the Shenong Benzhao Jing categorizes herbs or medicinal substances in upper, middle, lower, and the upper is that the ones associated with heaven, they're for immortality, the middle ones are for kind of longevity, taking as tonics, that sort of thing. And then you have the lower class associated with earth, and those are for treating disease. So the Shenong Benzhao Jing is not a text that was written for clinical application. In the Song Dynasty, and then you have formula, so you have Benzhao literature. Then you have formula literature, like the Shang Hanlun and Jingwei and other texts. And then in the Song Dynasty, you have a development where the clinical ideas about the Wuxing, the five elements, about treatment and diagnosis and channels and all of the stuff, it starts flowing, it flows into the materia medica literature. And materia medica literature changes and begins incorporating, it becomes clinically useful.
Ah, okay.
And you don't have that in the Han Dynasty. They were basically separate literary traditions. And the Fuxing Zhuo is absolutely fascinating to me because it is a combination of formulas and it has this funky section in the middle that categorizes 25, I want to say, substances by the five, we can call them five dynamic agents, five elements, whatever.
Well, I mean, that would make sense because you've got five dynamic agents. It's a great translation. And then with each one, so you got like the water within the water, and you got the fire within the water, and the earth within the water. And I mean, these are all ways that anyone who studied a little bit of acupuncture already knows how to think about.
Exactly.
Acupuncture in terms of the five phase correspondences. And so this is using herbs in a similar fashion.
Exactly. So it's really great when you think about most Chinese medicine practitioners in the US are primarily acupuncturists. They're primarily trained in acupuncture. And then it's really changing. Is that fair to say?
I don't know. I've been out of school for 20 years. So what would I know about what's happening in schools? I don't know anything. I'm not a teacher.
Well, you talk to people all the time.
Well, I talk to people, but that doesn't mean I understand anything about acupuncture education as it's currently unfolding. I'm not in that world. Most of the people I talk to are practitioners.
So my sense is that until about maybe 10 years ago, most people who learned about Chinese medicine, they learned to be acupuncturists.
I don't know. See, I went to a school where we learned both simultaneously and at the same time. So,
and the reality in China, of course, is that that
they're separated.
Medicinal treatment is that is like the you know, that's the pride of the scholar physicians, is the medicinal formulas. But it's very difficult to learn. And here you have the Fuxingjue, which presents you with this, it's a historical text, and it presents you with a way of understanding 25 herbs according to this five-phase, five-element categorization that is quite useful if you want to learn about herbs. Makes sense, right?
Yes.
It's a great teaching tool. That's what I heard first about the Tang Ye Jing, that it was a text that was really helping. It was like, oh, wow, I finally started learning about herbs.
Especially from that point of view of the five dynamic agents.
Yes.
It's like another perspective, another way of looking at these medicinals that we use, bringing in that five-phasal thinking. You could probably throw some, six Jing in on it as well and, make sense of things. We're not going to do that.
No.
We're going to stick with the five-phase piece because it's, there are so many different perspectives that we have with our medicine. It's easy to kind of like mishmash them together, but I think it's probably more helpful to try to understand them as they are within like whatever kind of method it is, and then see what that method actually has to say once you understand the pieces of it.
Yes, and it makes sense, right, that when you have this way of if you can categorize herbs in that way, or we should really say medicinal substances, even though in this case these 25 were herbs, but one of the things is that one of the versions of the Fuxingjue also has a whole categorization on minerals, which nobody who's presenting the Tang Ye Jing in this country in English ever talks about. So there are aspects of this Fuxingjue that are found in some manuscript versions and not in other manuscript versions that have been eliminated because in modern practice in America, we don't really use minerals in that way. We're not. So, here's another little red flag, just a little side note, but basically having the scheme of classifying herbs is really helpful when you're trying to study herbs, when you're beginning to, like I know when I taught at the college in Portland, NUNM, the students were just, studying these herbs is overwhelming. And all you're doing is memorizing. You're memorizing point names, you're memorizing herbs, you're memorizing formulas. It's so having a scheme of classification, a structure it really helps.
Of course it does. Yes. But I'm still a little bit confused here. It's like, what's Fuxingjue? What's Tang Ye Jing? It's like, how's Tang Ye Jing fit into this? Because from my very, very limited understanding, it truly is like a unicorn. I mean, you hear about it at different points in time, and it's like supposed to be the underpinnings of the Shanghan Lun, but, and then it's got, of course, it's got this great creation story of, the magic chef and all this other stuff. But like, how do these things hang together? How do we even know that the Tang Ye Jing was something real and not made up? Sorry, this is a really hard question.
No, all I can see is rainbow colored unicorns dancing around. And it's like, Michael, you don't believe in unicorns.
No, but I mean, it's like, I mean, the thing has, I mean, my limited understanding, the Tang Ye Jing is this like mythic thing. And one of the things that concerns me, and I get this from myself and I see it in our profession. It's like, ooh, there's this kind of mythic thing. And I think it's easy to go, oh, there's like this mythic archetypical big, beautiful story. And we kind of love that story. And we might swallow the story because it's a nice story. But I mean, I'm this like guy in Missouri, for God's sake, right? The show me state. I want to know how this damn thing holds water.
Well, it doesn't. And that's the bottom line is the Fuxingjue. And this is what people just have to get in their heads. The Fuxingjue is not identical with the Tongyijing. The Fuxingzhi is a medieval text that was composed by an unknown author. It claims that it is by Tao Hongjing, but it's clearly not. I mean, Tao Hongjing was this really, really famous scholar, author, Taoist practitioner. Tao Hongjing, I mean, we know he compiled and authored so many books, including a revision of the Shenong Benzao Jing. We know so much about Tao Hongjing. He was incredibly literate. He was like Sun Simer. He's one of my great heroes. This text was not written by Tao Hongjing. There's just, and you can read my book about it. You know, we don't need to go into the details. But, I mean, I wrote this really, really long introduction on it. The text quotes Tao Hongjing, and it's probably not even really quoting Tao Hongjing. It claims to be quoting it. First, the text says it was compiled by Tao Hongjing, and then it quotes Tao Hongjing in the actual text, which already doesn't really make sense. So it was a text that was compiled that was somehow, it was just a text that made it into the Dunhuang cave that was sealed in the cave. So we've established that. The Tongyijing is a completely different story. And there is no historical reference. There is nothing at all outside sources that talk about the Fuxingzhi as being identical with the Tongyijing. There is no historical evidence for that. And it is also not something that the medical historians in China mentioned. Like all the books that I have on the Dunhuang medical manuscripts, they discuss this text. There's introductions, there's, you know, discussions afterwards, and they have critical footnotes, and you know, they talk about different versions of characters and all of this. And they just treat it like a medieval manuscript. It's great, it's interesting. Okay, great. Now, the Tongyijing, Tongyi means decoctions, and Jing means classic. There is a story, and we don't have to go into all the details, but...
I want the details.
Well, we'll be here until tonight.
Okay.
Yeah, we can...
I've got a lot of tape on this thing.
It's a long story. So there was supposedly... I mean, so the mythology of this whole text is there was a cook 2000 BCE, so 4,000 years ago, in the Shang Dynasty, who Ian... this famous chef who wrote the Tongyijing, and somehow magically, or he probably didn't write it because they weren't writing very much. He composed whatever, you know, it's kind of like the Taoist monk smoking a cigarette. You tell a good story. So whatever, he created the Tongyijing the way the divine farmer Shenong wrote the Shenong Benzao Jing. So it's a mythology, right? The divine farmer did not write the Shenong Benzao Jing. Just like the Yellow Emperor who lived, whatever. What are the dates for the Yellow Emperor? I mean, they have exact dates for the Yellow Emperor that are like 3,462 BCE to so-and-so. I'm not kidding you. I mean, Chinese love their history. We know that there was no such thing as a historical figure called Huang Di, and he did not write the Yellow Emperor's inner classic, right? We've progressed enough in our understanding of medical history that people like you accept that the Yellow Emperor's inner classic is a Han Dynasty text, even though it claims to be written by the Yellow Emperor who lived 3,000 years earlier, right? Say yes.
There was no Yellow Emperor? Wait a minute. Now I'm in deep trouble.
Oh my God, don't do this to me.
No, I get it. They're you know, again,
these are culture heroes, like mythological culture heroes. So
exactly, which is why I was saying there's like the, you know, it's like this mythical text. These things are like unicorns.
So Ian is actually mentioned in some Shang oracle bones. So we know that he was more historical than the Yellow Emperor. He was a minister or somebody who received sacrifices at the Shang Dynasty court. He is known in Chinese history as he was a slave who was presented to the Shang court from some other court, along with I forgot a wedding present or something like that, or somebody's birthday celebration or something, and he served the emperor, the Shang ruler. He served him soup and made friends with the ruler somehow, and somehow he rose to the position of minister. supposedly he created this classic of decoctions.
So it's a recipe of soups. I mean, literally, Tanya.
Yeah.
It's like soup. It's a book about soup.
But we don't know what the book is about.
No, but I'm just saying, if you say Tanya, Tanya basically means soup.
I mean, Tanya is used in formula literature, and it is used in texts like Sun Miao to refer to decoctions, because decoctions are soups.
But how do we know it's not just a recipe book of soups?
We don't know. The Tanya Jing is
the Martha Stewart soup book of, 4000 BC.
We don't know anything about the Tanya Jing. I mean, no, we don't. And okay, no, I don't want to make it a joke. It's not.
No, I mean, I don't want to make it a joke either. But what I'm really trying to get at here, because I love herbal medicine, and I love how things come down to us through time, and it often is through story, and yes. It is through the experience of one person teaching another person, and they like get what their teacher said, and they get their own insights about it, and they use that to practice, and they teach that to someone else, and these things come down and down and down through time to us today, and we have the privilege and the responsibility of stewarding this medicine, and I take that very seriously, and I'm delighted to be, a link in that chain. So I get it that it doesn't have, we don't have to necessarily have a book to go, there was this thing. Maybe it is a story. Some of the best stories out there are like fairy tales and stories of gods and archetypes and, things like that, because there's something that is true about it that can be perceived and used by us in, in this moment. A lot of things are metaphorical. It doesn't mean they're fiction. It means it gives us a chance to use our imagination and our heart. So being said,
and that's like the story about Sun Miao, that he lived in a cave with the dragon and the tiger. We don't have to believe in dragons and tigers.
I live in a cave with a dragon and a tiger. It's my own damn emotions that drive me crazy. I live in that cave. I mean, these things are, they're absolutely metaphorical and useful and true in many, many senses. So, but the thing I want to come back to again here, Sabina, is, I hear about this Tanya Jing, and what I'm hearing from you is that there's a way of taking herbs and understanding how they work through the five phases. And I've read through the introduction of your book, and it seems like different people throughout history have referred to this book. But it's like there's just little glimmers in snapshots over the course of centuries about it.
Yes. So there is a mention in a Han Dynasty. We don't hear anything about the Tanya Jing until the first mention is in a Han Dynasty bibliography. There's a record of Tanya Jing. And one of the problems is that Tanya, like you said, it just means soups or decoctions, if you want to say medicinal soup, something like that. And Jing just means classic, but it could also be classics. And I forgot how many scrolls it said in there. I think it says 10 scrolls. So it doesn't even have to be a book title. It could just be a record that there are 10 scrolls of classics of decoctions. Did it even say Jing? God, I don't even remember. I think it did. So it doesn't mention Ian. It doesn't say anything. It just says that it just mentioned this book. And then you have, oh man, this is why I'm a really bad historian. And that's when I teach, I always have to have PowerPoints because I jumble story. I'm a bad storyteller. I jumble things up. So basically, Zhang Zhongjing, in his preface, mentions the books that he used to develop his formulas. And he gives us a list of the famous physicians. He does not mention the Tanya Jing at all.
Isn't that a little suspicious?
I think that's really important.
I think it's important too. I mean, suspicious is probably not the right word. But I find it a curiosity that someone like Zhang Zhongjing, who would, if that was floating around at his time,
he would have mentioned it. There's no way. There's no way. And I translate the preface. I have all those passages. It's in my introduction. So, you know, you can all, and that's why the introduction is really long. And I have taken the time and energy and space to really translate each of these passages and explain the context, because you can create a story when you take little bits and pieces and kind of cherry pick them. You can piece things together, but you really have to look at, I mean, this is kind of what I had to do. You step back and you're like, okay, if the Fu Xing Jue is identical with the Tang Ye Jing, where would I look for evidence of that? And the preface to the Shanghan Lun would be the first place I would look for evidence. Well, it's not in there. So what does it mean? Sun Simiao mentions Yin cooking decoctions and Shen Nong doing tasting herbs, I believe. So there is, it's like there are these very, very faint traces, but there is not a single quotation of a Tang Ye Jing in any of the transmitted literature. We don't have the texts like the Ishinpo that I was mentioning earlier from Japan that has mentions all these lost texts. The Tang Ye Jing is basically a lost text, which is why it's such an attractive text. You can claim anything about it because it was lost and nobody knows anything about it. Except that Sun Simiao mentions Ian.
It's mythic. It's got this mythic appeal to it.
I mean, there was like some kind of a, and it makes sense that Ian was the celebrated minister who started out as a chef. So, you know, the Shenong, the divine farmer, tasted herbs. The Yellow Emperor wrote the inner classic that this chef somehow gets, you know, credited with cooking decoctions. But nobody received in the standard literature mentions a Tang Ye Jing, quotes any of these formulas as a quotation from the Tang Ye Jing. The only thing is, there are, and this is, I think, where people, this is the reason why people associate the Tang Ye Jing with the Fu Xing Jue. One is that a couple of times, and I go through this in my introduction, the words Tang Ye or Jingfang, so classical formulas or decoctions, they're used in the Fu Xing Jue. And there's one place, I believe it was the introduction to that section on the herbs being categorized in this Wuxing structure. In the introduction, I believe it's Tao Hong Jing is quoted as, he's never saying, I'm quoting the Tang Ye Jing. And that's the thing. It's like people just assume that the Fu Xing Jue is identical with the Tang Ye Jing. And the problem is that people have this idea in their head and it's not based on reality. If you look, the Fu Xing Jue does mention the Tang Ye Jing, or it mentions Yin composing the Tang Ye Jing, like Shen Nong composing the Shen Nong Bensao Jing. But it does not say this section comes from the Tang Ye Jing. It does not ever identify, and it quotes from lots of other classics. So there are the Fu Xing Jue is a compilation of quotes from a bunch of different texts, but it does not identify any section in it as identical with the Tang Ye Jing. And people now take the entire Fu Xing Jue, or at least the piece, I mean, they don't take the mineral section. They take one version of the Fu Xing Jue and claim that that is identical with the Tang Ye Jing, which is a leap of faith that is just not okay. And then they say that this Tang Ye Jing is ancestral to Zhang Zhongjing. And that is completely made up.
Well, if it was ancestral, and if Zhang Zhongjing actually used it, I mean, he was very good about explaining where he got his stuff. Why would he not mention that?
Right.
So this is what I'm, you know, again, I hate to keep harping on this, but I'm going to keep harping on this.
Let me give one more piece of the puzzle, which is that there's one section at the end of the Fu Xing Jue, which is the section of the yin and the yang dan or dawning formulas and the six spirit formulas. And that section contains almost literally identical versions of formulas that are in the Shanghanlun and Jingwei. And that is why people claim this. That is another piece of the puzzle that we have to mention, that there is a close textual overlap between Zhang Zhongjing's work and certain formulas in the Fuxingjue. Now, my argument would be the other way around. Zhang Zhongjing's work is quite famous, and we can date with we know that some version of the Shanghanlun and Jingwei existed in the Han Dynasty. We know that the Fuxingjue is a 5th to 6th to 10th century text. So it makes no sense to claim that the Fuxingjue predates Zhang Zhongjing's writings. It just makes, it's a complete, to me, it's a historical, it just makes no rational sense. It makes much more sense to say, oh, the Fuxingjue quotes from Zhang Zhongjing's writings.
And these are some modifications of the formulas and modifications of ways of thinking about Zhang Zhongjing's work.
Almost literal quotations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it is possible that both of them are derived from a mythological Tang I Ching, but why? I mean, that's what the claim is, I think. But then you're adding this whole other layer that the Tang I Ching is lost. So adding that both Zhang Zhongjing and the Fuxingjue are derived from the Tang I Ching doesn't really, it just muddies the story even more. When to me, it's just like, okay, Zhang Zhongjing's formulas are here. They were incredibly effective. They were useful. It makes perfect sense that a medieval text contains all these different layers from different centuries and different, you know, people quoted and preserved and transmitted orally. So just because this medieval text contains a few formulas that are almost literal quotations from Zhang Zhongjing, doesn't mean that the text is Han Dynasty. Does that make sense?
Yes. And as we're having this conversation, I'm realizing, I mean, I've had inklings of this for a while. As a clinician, I don't care where it comes from. As a clinician, I'm concerned with, oh, here's a perspective. Can I understand it in a way that allows me to be helpful to people in my practice? That for me is first and foremost. Now, I like a good story as much as anybody else. But again, I come back to, is it helpful in clinic?
That is ultimately why I got into this introduction, because I could have just translated it and just put it out there for people and stayed out of the whole controversy.
No, I'm really happy that you took us on that Chinese medicine history train. And for any of you that have not yet read the book, the clinical information in there is helpful. If you're an herbalist, it's a perspective that's worth considering because it will help you to think more deeply about the work that you do. You can never go wrong with thinking more deeply about the work that you do if you're interested in your work. But the thing I find most fascinating about this, Sabine, is the way that you really have gone through the different centuries and the different texts and looking at it with your Chinese medicine historian eyes, as well as a translator of classical Chinese, and like not giving us an answer, but helping us to better understand the puzzle.
I think something that became really clear to me when I worked with Sharon Weizenbaum on, she did a little commentary on the, or not a little, she did a great commentary on that last section with the dawning formulas and the six spirit formulas. And she did a foreword for me. And we went back and forth where we met pretty much every day for hours on Zoom. Sharon loves Zoom. And you know me, I'm not a great friend of Zoom, but we would just get together in the morning. It was like, I'd wake up and she's 3 hours ahead of me and there'd be like 5 emails from her. And it was like that when I used to work with Nigel Wiseman, when we did the Jingwei together, it was like, I would wake up and there'd be like, you know, a pile of emails from Nigel about this and this and that. And I would work through them. And then this was before the age of Zoom. But then Sharon and I talked really closely. And what really came out of that is the Fuxing Jue is a fascinating text. It's really helpful. It's cool. It's formulas addressing the Zhang organs, which was an innovative thing at the time. And this scheme of classifying the medicinals, you know, I'm not a clinician. That is for you. But a lot of my clinician friends are finding it really wonderful and helpful and useful. So here I am. Here's the translation. You do with it. You know, you make it clinically useful. But the really important part for that introduction and the reason I did all that work is because we have to treat the text realistically, and if we read the text as a whole, the entire Fuxingjue, as a sacred Han Dynasty classic that predates Zhang Zhongjing, it changes the way we read this information in a way that might lead you down the wrong path. It's very different if you read my translation as a sacred, as a Jing. Because when we read a sacred, ancient Jing, right? A Jing is kind of a timeless, it's the classics in Chinese philosophy and medicine were preserved through thousands of years because there's something timeless and incredibly precious in them. And for me, if I don't understand a line in the Laozi or in the Yellow Emperor's classic, I don't say the text is wrong. I say, oh, I'm just not as enlightened as the people who compiled the Su Wen. The Su Wen is so deep. I know there are passages in the Su Wen that I don't get because I'm not enlightened. I don't have the sensitivity to the fluctuations of yin and yang that the authors of the Su Wen have. And maybe I can come back to it in 5 years and I can intuit it. Or a lot of times I would get it in my dreams or when I go swimming or, you know, I have to step back from it for a week or a month. And then I go, right. My MO when I read a Jing, a classic, is if it doesn't ring true with me, if I don't get it, it's because my understanding is too limited. Maybe the translation is wrong. In case, if you're reading it in English, there's, I don't blame the text. I blame myself.
Well, I don't know if blame is the appropriate word. I think there are stages of development, right? Children at the age of 3 can understand certain things, but not others. By the time they get to 11, yeah, there are certain things they can understand.
Yes.
When they turn 17, there's more they can understand. When they become an adult, and maybe they're in their 40s, there's even more that you can understand. Some of it's not about like blame that you're not enough of something. It's just sometimes you need a certain amount of development before you go, oh, right, that's what they're talking about. And that aspect of Jing, that there's this thing that runs through it. There's a thread literally that runs through it. I always get a little persnickety around the word sacred because it, you know, it's used as a big stick to beat people with so often. But this idea that there is something that like through time holds an element of something essential that we can get and will be helpful for us as human beings. That makes sense to me. Just like there's certain things in every generation that get like rediscovered, but actually our parents knew about it, our grandparents knew about it. You know, people have known about it through history. It's just that, you know, we kind of have to learn a lot of things on our own when you're an individual.
Yeah.
So that Jing piece is...
So that's a Jing, yeah, right?
Yeah.
And if we read the Fuxingjue, if we claim that the Fuxingjue is actually the Tang Ye Jing in that sense of a classic from the Han Dynasty. Mm-hmm. And if we treat it as something that is ancestral to Zhang Zhongjing. It just gets really confusing. To me, as a medical historian, it doesn't make sense. This text, the content of this text, it could not have been composed prior to Zhang Zhongjing's work, because it reflects a way of looking at the Wuxing and the Zhangfu organs and formulas and herbs and medical theory that is medieval. It just wasn't there in the Han Dynasty. So it's intellectually confusing because it's you're reading the text ahistorically. But when you're just reading it as a Dunhuang manuscript, you know, it's
and helpful.
Yeah, it's
Nazi Book of Tricks.
Yes. And it says in the text that it comes from this environment of Taoist, like Tao Hongjing. I mean, it claims to be by Tao Hongjing, but we know it's not. But it basically, it was written by these, or compiled by these Taoists that were living in the mountains. They were pursuing immortality. People like Sun Simiao, their goal was to become immortal. And it was, this book is like the first step of keeping yourself safe when you're up in the mountains. And here are 25 herbs. And these 25 herbs are all you need to keep yourself when you have an emergency that affects this Zhang organ and this Zhang organ. And then, oh, there's this whole other piece, which is really cool about the Tianxing, Waigan, the externally contracted celestial movements or actions or whatever, that last section. I mean, see, there's like, the text is really cool because it comes from this group of people who were living in the mountains with very limited, they were not in the capital. So they had limited access to medicinal substances. And they're creating these formulas. And that last section is about responding to, we had the Tea Time Talk, I believe, on it, where we talked about Waigan. With Iran Evan. About why the heavenly movements, the external contractions. And this question, is it external contractions or is it just like an external stimulus that the human body is responding to, and it is responding to with pathology when it is out of alignment with the movements or the actions in heaven? Mm-hmm. And of course, heaven can always mean nature. So the text was written to help humans come into better relationship with the movements in heaven. So it's a really cool text. It's just...
The other thing to me that's cool about it, and again, speaking as an herbalist, I mean, herbal medicine is hard to learn and it can be really confusing. I found that shortcuts don't work. I've tried them and they don't work. I've tried shortcuts. I wish they worked. They don't. That being said, when I think of like, oh, if I could really grok mm-hmm. the way that 25 herbal yeah. substances work along with the five phases, then maybe it will help me to understand the underlying mechanism.
Yes.
Like how some formulas work and how herbs work together and how I can think about it in terms of five phases. I love that I can take something, I don't know. I mean, when I think about like, okay, 120 herbs, I got to learn all that. It's like, oh my God, you know what? I need to go wash the car right now. But when I think about 25 and I think about connecting it with something that I already am beginning to get a feel for after, you know, 20 years of practice, like the five phases, I think, oh, this is a doable endeavor. And especially yeah. the thought of, if I only need, you know, it's like, if I don't have access to a whole bunch of herbs, what are the essential ones that I need to think about? So I love that it's kind of minimalist in a way.
Yes.
And at the same time, it can help me to understand the more complex aspects of herbology as well.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that you can look at these formulas, because like the first section has formulas for each of the Zhang organs. And you can look at, and there's certain herbs that are used over and over again. And then they're altered depending on the agent or element of that organ. And I think you're absolutely right that you can, like, there's, this text is really cool, and you can, and this is for a clinician. This is for somebody like you. And this is always my hope with all my work is here's the translation. This is what I do. This is the history. This is the context. This is the translation. And now you guys go out there and you teach this material and you see whether it makes sense to you. Like Sharon Weitzenbaum, who did the commentary on the dawning and the six spirit formulas, like that's really cool. And she does connect it to the Liao Jing. And it's like, whoa, it's right over my head. But it's great. And I love working with, you know, somebody like that and seeing there's like a translation of it. It's a transmission is really what we're all doing.
Well, again, we are fortunate to be involved in this medicine, that some of it comes through books, some of it comes through stories, some of it comes through experiences of people that we're kind of connected to in whatever lineage we are connected. But the most important thing is that it is able to come alive in our experience and in our practices.
Yes.
And so I am deeply grateful for the work that you do in bringing these kinds of things to us and in the poetic way that you approach it. Your books are so much fun to read. I'm gonna gush here for just a second. I love Chinese medicine. I love the stuff that we do. And sometimes reading it and studying it is just, it's tedious and it's boring and it's dry. I mean, it's just, I'm gonna have to have really good tea to power me through it because it's dry. A lot of the material is dry. But you infuse a kind of linghua, kind of liveliness to it and bring in these other influences. I just, you know, and you use puns and you kind of make little jokes. I mean, if you read any kind of Chinese, you make little jokes all the way along in the way you do things. And so I just find that your way of doing it that's uniquely you makes it more accessible for me because it's fun.
The texts are, you know enough Chinese, you know.
No, I know modern Chinese.
Like, it makes me sad when people think that the Yellow Emperor's classic is this awful thing. Like, it was never meant to be read cover to cover. And these poor students have to read the whole thing for a class. And it's like when we did that little class on Suwon 5, right? You take a little passage and it is so rich and it is so poetic and beautiful and philosophical. And there's this deep, deep cosmic wisdom in it. And if you just sit down and read it in English, like that just gets lost. And you're right, it's painful to read it like that, cover to cover.
Well, you know what the Huangdi Neijing actually was, don't you?
This is a trick question.
No, it's not a trick question. The Huangdi Neijing was the first podcast on Chinese medicine. It was the first conversation recorded on Chinese medicine.
No, it was not a podcast. It was a person. It was an in-person. They got to sit and share tea.
Yes, they got. Yes, they did.
Conversation. They got to give each other a real hug. They probably got to throw pillows at each other when they disagreed. Well, not quite.
Well, but all I'm saying is, podcast today is the technology that we have for taking dialogue, conversation, and inquiry.
Yeah.
And using it to understand medicine and how to practice it. And the Huangdi Neijing was a conversation. It was a dialogue. It was two people, probably more, but, you know, at least the characters in the podcast there.
Yeah.
People discussing and chewing over, like, how's this stuff work? This world that we find ourselves in, this medicine that we have, the way human beings are. It's like, how's this stuff work? And it's not that different from what you and I are doing right now.
And I think it has to be. I think it's so deep and complex. It has to be a conversation.
It has to be a conversation. So, Sabina, thank you for this conversation. This has been an utter delight. Where do people go to get this book?
HappyGoatProductions.com. I used to sell goat cheese, and now I sell books. And the name still works.
I'll be sure to put a link to it over on the show notes page.
I'm waiting for the proof in the mail, and everything is taking forever right now. But yeah, it'll be. I always aim for the holidays, right? I'm always like, oh, this one we'll have it out in October, no problem. And then it's always like the Chinese New Year. It just seems like
okay. Chinese New Year is very auspicious.
I know. All that's right. My excuse. And then it's like the New Year, and then it's like, oh yeah, I was talking about the Chinese New Year. No, it's basically done.
Great.
Yeah.
So by the time all y'all are listening to this, you'll be able to buy a copy. I can't wait to get mine. Sabina?
Well, where's my time to ask you questions? Wait a minute.
What questions do you have? You have some questions for me right now, or you want to do this in a different podcast? What do you want to do?
I want you to read the book, and then I would love to. Yeah, I want to have a conversation about what it means. I want to know if I'm onto something or if it's complete floofy stuff about this external. Well, I really, okay, I have one question. Do we have time?
Yeah.
This Weigan, external, we always translate it as external contraction. And that's that group of formulas in the Fuxingzhi, the last section. It's about the externally, I translate it as externally contracted celestial movements. And I think we should say that celestial could just mean natural. So it could be the movements, the actions in the macrocosm.
You mean like coronaviruses suddenly running around the neighborhood?
Yep, exactly. Yeah. And of course, we can associate it with whatever. And I should also say that the first character in the Fuxingzhi, in the title, that Fu, is the name of the star Alcor, which is a star in the Big Dipper, not in the handle, but in the pot part of the Big Dipper. And when I was working on the title for the book, that star talked to me and it's like, you want to write a book about celestial secrets? I'll show you. And it's been just like getting slammed with the power of the stars. It's like, yeah, you want to think about movements in heaven, movements in the sky. It's like, oh yeah, right. Good luck. So there's a whole other story to this title that we could have gone down another rabbit hole.
But your question?
So the question is this Weigan. We think of it as external contraction. And of course, we think of Weigan Tianxing. It's translated as epidemics in modern. It's equated with the Wenyi, the warm epidemics, whatever, and seen as a development of the Shanghan cold damage. Mm-hmm.
Some sort of external thing is coming in and mucking with the internal environment.
So do you think it's crazy? Or do you think there's more going on when we think of gan in the sense of stimulus? Like when you translate it as external contraction, it sounds so clinical and sterile. Like what's your opinion about the resonance between the human body and the move, the how do you see these Tianxing? Is that too weird?
Well, let me see if I'm understanding the question. You're asking about the human body's ability to deal with things that come from the outside in nature. That could be anything from a virus to how the stars are moving and the universe happens to be at that moment in time. Yeah?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a broad question. I mean, my sense,
is this clinically useful to you?
Well, I mean, it helps me in terms of thinking about, like, what am I doing with my work? And it helps me in thinking about, like, okay, so a human being is an ecosystem nested within larger ecosystems of culture, of family, of country, of, you know, time and place, where we've got all these, like, nested interlocking relationships with nature. Human being, human body, human spirit being like, you know, one aspect. And, you know, it's like that question about like, what's the definition of health? You could talk forever about that one. But it seems to me that as human beings, whether you're deciding that, you know, we ended our skin or we, you know, somehow are bigger than that, You know, are we talking about the physicality? Are we talking about our social self, our psychological self, you know, the aspect of us that's part of a family? There is, at every level of nature that I can perceive, an inside and an outside, right? And we see this in Chinese culture, right? Neo Guanxi, right? It's like you have a relationship with something. Rugo Neo Guanxi, not Mayo Guanxi, right? If you got a connection with something, okay, things are cool. My suspicion is that our work is about dealing with influences that come into us, whatever we consider the us to be, and either help us in our life or are problematic to us in our life. And that can be anything from a thing like the coronavirus to a bad childhood to a good education to good friendships or a nice cup of tea, right? There's an inside, there's an outside. There's kind of an us and a them.
Or is it an interior and exterior?
Well, you can call it interior, exterior. I've got a bunch of different names for it. The question is there a sense of harmonization between these things? And if there's harmonizing, if there's harmony between the different aspects, then, you know, things are pretty copacetic. It's when there's not a harmony between the inside and the outside, or the them and the us, or the me and mine, or the whatever, then we start having trouble. You know, I mean, what is Xiaqi? Xiaqi is, it's qi. How can you say it's evil? From Xiaqi's point of view, Xiaqi is just like, hey, I'm just going around doing my thing, right? It's only a problem, you know, from the side of me who might be suffering from it. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it does. It does.
Anyway, I'll read the book and we'll come back and you can ask me questions.
Okay, deal.
Okay?
Deal. You know, I'll hold you to it too.
All right, my friend. Thanks for this conversation today.
I've wondered over the years about how we can have much to say about a, air quotes here, lost text. And in this and some other conversations with Sabina, I've come to realize that you can trace the influence of lost texts through the writing of other doctors and through the commentaries that are such a rich source of considering our medicine. Having a historian's eye and the way that they can follow the footprints through time of a particular text, it helps me to better understand the influential echo of past doctors and writers and how they can influence this present moment. I hope that you found this conversation to be helpful. And remember, Sabina's book is for sale over at Happy Goat Productions. There is some useful, clinically relevant material in her translation of The Celestial Secrets. And as with all her translations, the medicine comes alive in only the way that Sabina can write it. Well, this pretty much wraps up January. Yeah, pretty much wraps up the year of the rat as well. Glad to see that one go. Tune in again next week for another excitingly geological conversation.